you know, all the empty spaces. No? Yeah. Okay, any question from previous thing, previous classes? We have gotten two already done. So anybody remembers anything from the past? Huh? Dasya Bhav. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Any question, any discussion, any comment, any like, how many likes, how many dislikes? No. मैं सेवक तो स्वामी कृपा करो भरता ओम जय जगदीश हरे. The entire whole India, all this this aarti prayer that you hear, it is called dasya bhav. Dasya meaning master and slave. Dasya, no? Bhava, dasya bhava. You are master, I am your slave. Have mercy on me. No? Tu mai murakh khal kami kripa karo bharata. I am idiot, I am stupid. I am a sinner and I am wicked. No? Kripa karo bharata. O giver, O provider, please have mercy on me. No? So according to your observation, you tell me, what do you see as a dominant element in most of the religions in the world? No, but no, I mean, isn't that this is the fact, this is the factor here. No? I have done this thing bad, this thing bad, this thing bad, you know, and whatever I was not supposed to do, I did. No? I am hopeless case, doomed, and please help me. That's one thing. That's one theme. Other theme is the idea of powerlessness. No? Idea of powerlessness. That I'm not capable of doing, and therefore, no, I may have not done something which I was supposed to do. No? That's another factor. And that's called dasya bhava. When you put it in right context, it makes very much sense. No? You see here how hopeless, how helpless we become when, let's say, even if we have a fever for a couple of hours, literally we become very helpless. You know, it's like just in a matter of few hours' time, all the, you know, our vitality and strength is drained, and suddenly we need help, assistance. One little blood clot, and we have, you know, we become paralyzed. Everything is still there, and we can't function. So if you put it in that context, it makes very much sense. But normally, this whole concept has been misused, no? And exploited. And we become conditioned, you know. And that's where, you know, one has to be watch out in this kind of relationship between, quote, God and ourselves. Second one is dasya bhava. Other prominent theme is Sakya. Sakya. Word is derived from Sakha. You know? Million years have gone by, Kiri, since I wrote this sign. That's how, you know, what is derivative from where it's derived. So this signifies that in linguistics, you know, and grammar. So, Sakha, K-H long A, Sakha, K-H-A long, Sakha. Sakha means friend. And Sakya means the essence of, or let's say the quality of Sakha, friend. So a very famous example is given between Arjuna and Krishna. The relationship between the two has always had been Sakha, you know, Sakya Bhava. He always, you know, Arjuna and Krishna treated each other as two good friends. Whereas there is another character, and this is good thing to know this story so that you can see how normally, where you, so that you can locate your own, you know, understanding and your own, you know, approach to God, divinity, higher reality. So Arjuna and Krishna. Arjuna and Krishna. Arjuna. Arjuna and Krishna. And another one is Sudama and Krishna. So these are two characters. So in Sudama's case is, he was also friend, childhood friend. Arjuna was childhood friend, relative, and all kinds of relationships are there. But the, as far as the interaction between the two goes, it was friend. They could laugh, giggle, share. You know, the boundary between the two was extremely thin, almost nothing, close to zero. Sudama, on the other hand, is childhood friend. They both were in school together. Although, miraculous stories about Krishna that he went to school hardly 64 days. You know, in those 64 days time, he mastered 64 different arts and sciences. But the story is something that it will help you that how there are several roles sometimes they get mixed. And that's where you can clearly see in your own personal case. That so the story is both of them were together and they used to take care of their teacher's cows, Krishna and Sudama. You know, and one day, both of them let the cows and other cattle in the for grazing, and meanwhile, you know, there came horrible storm, and they could not find any shelter. And before they left, the wife of teacher had given Sudama some, like you have this flattened rice kind thing. Once in a while we make poha for breakfast at the institute. So that kind of rice is easy to eat. Add some water. In few minutes time it becomes soft, you know, and you eat, drink water, and you are ready to work again. And whole piece of whatever amount was given, Sudama was supposed to split it in half with Krishna. And but it was very hard day. They both were separated. They were hiding under different trees, sticking to the stem, you know, trunk of the tree. Sudama was very hungry and he ate the whole thing. Kept thinking, well, let me start, and when the storm becomes a little weak, then I will offer it to Krishna. And very soon, before he realized, he finished everything. No. And he felt horrible, but it was already finished. Well, now here comes layers of the stories. That Guru heard that Krishna is starved yesterday. Guru went to her. What you did, oh my God. May God protect you. Soon after, the both friends departed. One went and became prince of his small kingdom, started leading very active political life. Another became a teacher. And whole life he suffered from abject poverty. Why? Because he ate Krishna's share of the food, which he was not supposed to. See here, what kind of concept is coming into? Without sharing the food which you are supposed to share with your friend, you ate, and here whole lifetimes poverty comes in. They are friends. Sudama did not know that Krishna is such an enlightened master. Perhaps it could have inspired him both ways. He is that great enlightened soul. Therefore, it's not a big deal if I eat whole thing. This interpretation could have gone that direction. Or, oh my God, how can I eat without offering him? And what's the big deal? If I die out of starvation, at least I will die in his presence. That's his great salvation. It's not called dying, it's called salvation. So it could have, you know, the interpretation could have gone in any direction, but it went only in one direction. That here is such a horrible, you know, thing he did, that now he is suffering from extreme starvation, you know, hunger and poverty. But he used to tell the stories that, you know, Krishna is my friend, and we used to do this, he used to do that. Children are hearing it, wife is hearing it. One day, wife got fed up. He said, you know, if he's that great, you know, why don't you go and get some help? No, all day long all we are doing is just going from door to door asking for some little alms. And we don't get enough even to feed our children. So he has his own interpretation that he's my friend, and how can I ask? It is furthermore, God knows anybody will recognize or not. So that's what happened. It took many, many days. He kept, you know, convincing people that he's an old friend of Krishna. And then finally, somebody went and informed Krishna, and Krishna was very much moved, and he immediately ran and greeted him and brought him to his house. You know? And his wife this time had given almost same thing what teacher had given many, many years earlier. You know. But he was embarrassed to offer it to Krishna because it was just simply flattened rice. You know. And how can I offer to this little thing to one who is the king and has everything at his palace? And Krishna kept pushing. Tell me. What have you brought? You know, any bhabhi, meaning your wife, you know, what isn't that she must have given something, must have given for me? So she must have sent something for me. So finally he said, yes, here is this. Is. So Krishna was very happy, excited, just started eating immediately. So there were three fistful of that flattened rice. So he finished one, he finished two, and then Krishna's wife held his hand. Stop it. You already gave so much. Where are you? Where is the place left for you then afterwards? Because one fistful means, you know, anything earthly, another fistful, anything heavenly, and third one is anything that exists beyond heaven. You are already just giving away. At least, you know, as long as you have a body, we should have some place to live. So that's when he stopped. And then miraculously, when he was returning, Krishna did not, you know, and he did not realize what Krishna has given, so he's feeling very horrible, you know. What a life, you know, look at his, he has everything, but so stingy. Even he didn't realize why I came, and I did not ask, but he should have asked the purpose of my coming. But when he reaches home, then he saw a totally different world, was confused. Have I lost my mind? Have I come back to the same very place where, to Krishna's palace? It seems exactly like his palace. Then, you know, people recognized, they ran, and they said, no, okay. So see here, here is friend, but friend kept recognizing himself. His friend, at the same time, he is such a lowly man. Whole idea, and he was suffering from this feeling, do I deserve, you know, anything? Do I deserve even to go and stand at his door? No. So this is, the two feelings are mixed. I'm a friend, and I'm such a lowly person that do I really deserve to be a friend? Do I deserve to be treated as a friend? Is it appropriate for myself to present as a friend? Present myself as a friend. This is the story of Sakya, but there is Arjuna's case. Arjuna did not have this complex. He was fully aware that Krishna is someone great. Also, Arjuna was aware that he is not that low-grade fellow either. And this realization that I am not a low-grade fellow did not make him become arrogant. In fact, Arjuna had 10 names, and one of the names was Krishna. Arjuna's one of the names is Krishna. And under that name, he did not feel that he was anything less than Krishna. In this lifetime, he has assumed certain roles, and I have assumed certain roles. And for some important reason, he is in a guiding position and I am not. Okay. That was a very clear understanding that Arjuna was very clear about it. And while retaining this understanding, both of them have done all kinds of things together. However, during this horrible war, when so many kinsmen, family members are standing from the same family, you know, members of the same very family are standing in the battlefield, ready, you know, against each other, ready to kill and ready to be killed. And where Arjuna is evaluating that what is the ultimate outcome of it, and is it worth it to fight for one's rights? No. Clearly it is my right, I must claim my right. For last 40-60 years we have been unjustly treated by our cousin brothers. Furthermore, being in a ruling capacity as a ruling family, members of the ruling family, we have certain social responsibility. That is, defend justice. In that capacity, also, I must stand firm and fight for justice and freedom, liberty, whatever these American terms are. Freedom, justice, liberty. And yet, he's able to see that the other party has prepared for this war for last 60, 70 years. It was very, very, very prolonged preparation. And he was able to see the possible outcome of this war. And therefore, he was trying to avoid. See, the gap between First World War and Second World War is very little. First World War ended by 1915, is it correct? 18. And here and there the tussle started in early 30s. By 36 it was quite active. So how many years? Just hardly 18 years. And not less than 18 years. In 18 years' time, how much preparation was done? And the shocking thing is how little we know about World War II. Absolutely close to zero we know about World War II. Close to 0%. We know only about American involvement and its direct involvement in Germany and Normandy. The destruction that took place in China during the World War II is as painful as what you hear about Nagasaki, Hiroshima, and many of German cities. There are places in China that are just completely flattened. How many of you know that World War II was fought in Vietnam and Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Cambodia, China? Have you heard that? Very little. How many soldiers came from India, in World War II? And died? 2.5 million Indian soldiers came from India to fight in Europe. They vanished. Whereas the madness was really not that horrendous madness during the First World War or Second World War. Still, there are great, great souls all over the world, and they are trying to calm down human consciousness. There are many, many people as good and great as Mahatma Gandhi all over the world, during that time. And yet, this much destruction and the pain and the sorrow and grief caused by that destruction and anger came about. So Arjuna is able to see that this is the final decisive moment. And those wars were not like today's wars, where just drop bomb and continue flying with your fighter jets. No. Face to face, just like that, even during the American and British war, face to face, first front row people, they just from this side, from that side, front people die, second people in the soldiers from the second row just come forward, as though if you are just simply killer machines. Destroy others and destroy yourself, and then whoever gets destroyed first, is the loser, and whoever gets destroyed, later is the winner. That was the system even in those days. So Arjuna is confused. Is it worth it? Isn't that better? I can live like a life of a philosopher. Abandon my duties. And that is when very amazing word comes from Arjuna that sets the whole tone of about ourselves, about many of other sadhakas, those who are trying to understand what to make out of this whole idea of God, ourselves, the world around, dharma, etc. And therefore, really look at the nature of bhakti, love and devotion. This is, I don't remember the exact verse number in Bhagavad Gita, but the verse is, Karpanya dosopahata swabhavah prichami tvam dharma sammoodha cheta yachreyah syanishchitam brohitan me shishyasteham shadhi mam tva prapannam. That was the time when perhaps this is the only second time. First time Krishna forced himself as a teacher to come forward and guide Arjuna. The misery was not big enough for Arjuna even to think that I should actively seek some guidance from Krishna. This time, misery was very intense and it has caused great confusion. He was absolutely confused and he's acknowledging it. Karpanya dosopahata swabhava. My swabhava, essential nature, has been so badly beaten up, so badly injured, that I have become a petty-minded person and I know it. On one hand, I know that what needs to be done, that needs to be done, there is no question about it, and it is foolish to think whether or not I should do it. If this is my dharma, then what could be the outcome of my dharma? That should not be my concern. And yet, I am so badly affected by the prospect, the outcome, so badly affected by the possible outcome of this war. And which is a very calculated outcome. It means, and he saw it, little over 1.67 billion soldiers are ready in the battlefield, there. And everybody will die. They are all young people. That means there will be extreme, just like suddenly, there will be absolute shortage of adults and young adults. It means who will be left? Elderly and very, very young ones. And womankind. Worse than the destruction of these adults, the death of these adults will be what comes afterwards. Children will suddenly become orphans. That many orphans will be there. And each such adult's death will create minimum of 3 to 4, even more, orphans. It means this world will be left with orphans. No guidance, no school, no college, no agriculture, no commerce. After that, people will be just drowning in grief. And Arjuna, in other many associated texts that discuss, in fact, beautiful literature was written right at the time of a little after World War II by great writer called Chatur Sen Shastri. That was a very good blend of World War II and Mahabharata war. And the title comes right from the Bhagavad Gita, Vayam Rakshamaha, Sambhavami Yuge Yuge. I come to this world Again, I come to this world again and again, Krishna is telling. Whenever dharma declines, I come to this world to defend dharma, protect people, things like that. So there it talks about that what happens. And even at the genetic level, people are talking about genetics, DNAs. The thing is, the effect of, and this is fortunately people are now, even the scientists are recognizing that certain intense emotions, mainly grief or intense anger, prolonged intense anger, prolonged intense grief, just literally twists, you know, and distorts our genetic structure and genetic properties, just as a good, powerful, gigantic tornado just twists the big metals like ropes. We have seen it through our own eyes. The force of Ganges water is so strong when Ganges floods that even our metal poles standing in front of, you know, in our barbed wire fence, you know, the poles, strong metal poles, they are just twisted as though, it's just totally bizarre to see how water can, you know, be that forceful. And when the tornado came in Khajuraho in last week of January 2013, it was just shocking. The beams of our roof of the kitchen, heavy duty metals. In the morning time we saw, it was just twisted in such an amazing way. And whole the roof was gone and few metals and, you know, just sitting there. And it was just extremely small range tornado. It did not happen anywhere, just 10, 20 feet wide. You know, where it started, where it ended, even we do not know. It just swirled there, put everything, and therefore, that's how the grief, it's called shoka. Strong pain and sorrow, which is charged with grief, anger, fear, and powerlessness, it just literally twists and rubs, and like, you know, spaghetti, it just, you know, mixes everything, and you never know what kind of genetic characteristics will begin to manifest in that generation afterwards. Arjuna is seeing all that thing. Therefore, he knows his dharma, that this is my dharma to fight and defend the justice. And yet, what's the point in defending justice when nobody is there to reap the fruits of your justice? Therefore, he says, "Karpanya doso pahata swabhava." My mind, my essential nature, which I know is very luminous, intelligent, and discerning, and yet it is very badly affected by the possible outcome of this war, which I am very clearly able to see. Karpaine dosho pata swabhava. Therefore, prichhami tvam dharma sammoodha cheta. I'm asking you with a completely confused mind regarding what is my dharma here. And from sammoodha yachreya syan nishchitam brohitan me. Whatever is decisively good and auspicious for me and everybody else, please tell me. Shishya te aham, I am your disciple. Sadhi mam tva prapannam. Please, sadhi means not just simply guide. discipline me, straighten my buddhi. You know, I'm just at this moment, I become weak. That is, see here how Arjuna switches his role as a friend to being a student. This is what most of the scriptures so most of the scriptures are talking about that. So there are two kinds of scriptures. One is scriptures for namesake. In olden days, there was a time when Greek language held a very respectful place. Latin commanded that, you know, respect. Hebrew language commanded that respect. Sanskrit language commanded that respect. And there was a time when a small segment of society knew these standard classical languages, and the rest of the society did not. So if you wrote something in Greek, it gained, you know, it captured the attention. When the Greek was a spoken language, there were also very many languages. Until 50 years ago, there were very many large range of languages in the world. In the last 50 years or 100 years, at least 50% languages have died throughout the world. And languages which are not commercially viable are dying very fast. You know? It's a consumer-driven society. So if the particular language is not competent enough to be used as a vehicle to buy and sell our consumer items, they die. Hindi, for example. People in India are working very hard, and the quality of Hindi is declining. And probably in the next 50 years' time, there will be totally different Hindi language, and standard Hindi will be left only in the form, only in, as a classical language for the scholars. And everything else will be replaced by English. So this is what happens. No? Therefore, people wrote scriptures. Anything they were able to write, they wrote. If you were able to write in Sanskrit, immediately its value went up. Despite the fact utility was not much, not very many people understood. But those who understood were influential people. Lots of books have been written, you know, within the context of India, I'll say. Lots of books are there in Sanskrit which are like trash. And yet they are called scriptures. And if you say it's trash, then remember, there are Talibans not only in Islamic culture, there are Hindu Talibans too. They will really, you know, make sure that you no longer exist on the planet because you insulted their scripture. So, for example, one of the lowest grade scripture is Shiva Purana. Shiva is very great God. The word Purana is greatest set of scriptures. How do you dare to say that it is a low-grade book written by some low-grade pandit, Sanskritist? But read it. It's just very bizarre. So bizarre, as I was telling, you know, other day, that There are stories of, let's say, Shivalingam worship. Remember that story I told you? I think that was very, very first day probably, or second day of this, you know, that story. Do you want me to remind you? Very bizarre story, you know. Shiva is infatuated and he ran after somebody's wife, and when the husband comes and he saw how horrible things Shiva had done, so he cursed, and therefore his, you know, male organ, you know, just got dismembered. No? And then the Parvati held it. No? And that's why Yoni and Linga worship began. Just imagine how low-grade mind must have been even to conceive this idea. You know? And what kind of collective consciousness must have prevailed in those days that they thought that, wow, how significant is this thing, and that is why I should be worshipping it. You know? On one hand, we demand, you know, that, you know, those who commit rapes, you know, rape, you know, they should be punished. And here, such a horrible person who is raping others' wives, not just one or two, rather many, he is being worshipped because he raped somebody's wife. See here, how confused a mind must be, you know, to just embrace such things simultaneously. If I am mistreated, I need Shiva's help or God's help. Whereas if he does the same thing, you know, he should be worshipped. Same very act is ground for our worship. Same very act is ground for punishment, imprisonment. So this is a situation. But Arjuna is looking at this Sakya Bhava, but on the foundation of Sakya Bhava, the Maitrihood, you know, friendship, then he is, you know, what you call, extending himself as a student. There here suddenly comes a much deeper level of relationship. I'm not hopeless. I'm not horrible. I'm simply stuck at an important point in my life where it has become very hard for me to decide what should I do in my life at this moment. No? I seek your guidance. That is Arjuna and Krishna. Result? Not only that Krishna offered this knowledge, rather even he demonstrated. See here exactly what I am, and in case if there is any trace of doubt, I will even remove that doubt from your mind. What I am saying is, as Krishna says, based on an ancient wisdom which I have shared with very many other great souls in the past, and today I am sharing that wisdom with you. And if you think that how could I share this wisdom with those ancient ones, those who lived here many, many, many thousand years ago, and I was born just few decades ago. How can I share this knowledge with those who were born long before me? And therefore, let me tell you that my knowledge is completely intact. Birth and death does not affect me. I am able to see things from a totally different level, and what I see is absolutely correct. Proof? See here. You know, that how this whole world, past, present and future, is pervaded by me. You know? And then that's when in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna shows his cosmic form. And there he shares his whole knowledge. Result, the last verse of Bhagavad Gita. Nashtaha moho. My confusion and my delusion is destroyed. Arjuna acknowledges, proclaims, just as Krishna proclaimed knowledge and wisdom, and Arjuna proclaims that I got it. You know, it's very rare. These kinds of things you see very rarely in the scriptures. Perhaps Arjuna is one of those rare ones. And Nachiketa, exactly same thing. He tells what teacher teaches, just repeats it. And even in a more clear and in a more articulate manner than what teacher had done. So, Nashta Moho, Smritir Labdha, you know, I have gotten my memory back. Karishye Bachanam Tav. Now I will do exactly what you told me. Boom. Like everything, just whole shoka, all this grief and sorrow and confusion, it just vanished. And Arjuna exactly says, Nashta Moho, Smritir Labdha, Karishye Bachanam Tav. My memory has come back. Now I know exactly why I came to this world, why I was born. And I will do exactly what you just told me. Thus, he picked up his bow and bow and stretched the string of the bow and released it without any arrow. And the sound that came from that filled the entire sky. This is called Sakya Bhava, but later on that turns into student, you know, that is teacher-student Bhava. That is, you are my teacher, I am your student. Now, one thing is very important to remember here. Number one, this is the highest form of a relationship that has been, you know, described in the scriptures and highly, you know, admired. Number one. Number two, in this relationship, a student is supposed to know that he is a student. The more you know that you are a student, easier it is for a teacher to teach. What do you know whether or not you are a student? See, when you go to college, you know which courses you are taking. Based on that, you choose a teacher. You are taking chemistry classes. But in order to study your chemistry class, chemistry, you do not sit. In the classroom that is taught by geography teacher, you are learning physics, but you do not just blindly walk into the classroom where are discourses on linguistics or mythology. If that is the case, it means you are not a student. You do not know what you are trying, what are you studying and why. In order to teach you, then teacher also has to be equally blind. Teacher doesn't care who is coming into the classroom, what are his qualifications, and whether those who are there in the classroom are understanding anything or not. Like a tape recorder, teacher can just go on telling things After 40 minutes, 45 minutes, 1 hour, 2 hours, class is over, teacher is gone, and the students are gone. No? It does not work. This is one thing in bhakti yoga or any other form of yoga, one has to be very careful, but in bhakti yoga, it is even more important to know this thing. Because the whole idea of bhakti is based on faith. And sometimes this idea of faith is overstretched. Especially when we are constantly told, do not question, do not question, do not question. Especially when we are constantly told that a holy man is a holy man and his blessed fellow. When we are constantly told, no, that between us and the higher divinity, there is someone, you know, with higher power and authority. And it's simply submit yourself. Submission is a quality that we are expected to cultivate in order to practice our love and devotion in relation to God. So it becomes very tricky here. Now, this evening discussion is based on Bhakti Sutra of Narada. The amazing thing is, Bhakti Sutra of Narada is not raising this question at all. But there is another sutra called Yoga Sutra. You read Yoga Sutra, it's so clear that what makes you an ordinary person and what makes Guru an extraordinary person. If that Guru is not an extraordinary soul, then why should you bother to study with somebody who is as ignorant as you are? It is the knowledge that makes him a teacher or makes her teacher. And at least in that particular area where you want to learn something, if teacher does not know a little bit more than you, then why should you waste your time with that teacher? No. Kushalaha, the word comes, you know, in Yoga Sutra, Kushalaha. Who is Kushala? In this context, many, many supportive texts are there. For example, Ishopanishad, I'm quoting. Vidyancha, avidyancha. Yastadved, uhayam sah. Avidya, mrtum tirtva. Vidya, amrtam, asnute. Vidyacha, vidyancha, avidyancha. Yastadved, uhayam sah. Who is a teacher? Who knows vidya, knowledge? Who knows ignorance? Who knows the dynamics of knowledge as well as the one who knows the dynamics of ignorance? Such a person is true knower, the one who knows both ubhayam sah, and one who knows the relationship between light and darkness, real and unreal, between life and death, between vidya and avidya, between bondage and liberation. It's not only that you gain knowledge and that's it. You gain knowledge of absolute reality and whole life you struggle while living in the world. Because this world has its own unique power. Just because you are a great soul, the world is not going to spare you. You know? Just because, you know, you become a monk, the bank is not going to exempt you. You know? You are not going to get any exemption. You know? In fact, am I correct? You know, Maitri or somebody at the institute, living at the institute, wrote in the, you know, in the school system in the county, in our at a very what do you call township? No, what do you call that? Township? wrote a profession. No, we write our occupation. Somebody wrote monk, Hugh Monk. Sujata, do you remember who was that? Somebody, Maitri. It was Maitri. Humongous tax. You know, humongous tax. Yeah. Just as, you know, in really, really strict Islamic kingdoms, non-Muslims have to pay extra tax. Similarly, no, Maitri had to pay extra tax because she was monk. It is a punishment. This is, you have to pay extra because you are ignorant regarding the ways of this wonderful world, you know. Therefore, you pay more, you know. So, vidyancha, avidyancha, yastadvi. And this is what happens to, you know, us. A teacher could be a dangerous person if does not know the both side of the world. Why dangerous person? Why not a corporate person? Why not people of other profession? People of other professions are less dangerous than a spiritual teacher when a spiritual teacher does not have good functional knowledge of the both sides of the world. You know why? And I'm using the word dangerous. You are a young man. You are a young woman. In your 20s, you are just running around looking for a teacher. By the time you are in your mid-20s, you already switched 3, 4, 5 different churches, from one church to another church, from one priest to another priest, from one guru to another swami. And when you come to a spiritual person hungry for collecting students, wow! One more, you know, addition to my heart. Great idea. Especially he or she is young. You know, provide 10 to 12 hours of service. You know? But in 1 year time, 2 years time, 4 years time, many, many other samskaras, many, many other biological feelings and urges and cravings will manifest. Then what will happen? It will create problem to that person as well as it will create problem to your organization and to the teacher himself. So the teacher who guides without a direct experience of the both world can lead the students, especially in this particular field. In other field, it really is not that big deal, you know. You are learning, you know, music. Even, you know, a bad teacher could be quite, you know, good in certain aspects. You learn music, you know, and you don't bother too much, you know, about teacher's personal life, music teacher's personal life, you know, or your chemistry teacher's, you know, personal life. But here in this realm, actually the whole spirituality is related to the personal life. It is addressing our very, very basic personal human needs. The needs of our body, needs of our mind, needs of our soul. You know? And we are trying to understand our, you know, the correctness or incorrectness of our worldview. You know? And so it is, the most of it is actually related to the overall acknowledgement, identification, and transformation of our personality. Therefore, in this particular area, the understanding of a teacher and your relationship with the teacher and understanding of yourself as a student, you know, it's very, very, very crucial compared to many other fields of learning. Yeah. Therefore, that's what the scriptures are very much clear, very, very clear about it. Exactly whether you are, and this is where the analysis comes. The analysis in the bhakti yoga. Self, you know, the analysis, observation, self-examination is very, very necessary ingredient when you are trying to follow the path of love, devotion, and bhakti, trustful surrender. Trustful surrender could be extremely powerful, at the same time extremely tricky thing. Trustful surrender to who? Trustful surrender for what? You know? Are you trying to embrace this idea of trustful surrender to achieve something or to get rid of something? You must know it. Then you will be safe. You will not be a source of misery, source of problem to yourself and source of problem to anybody else. Normally that is where things go wrong in the practice of bhakti yoga. Observation tells us, when we examine things, it's very clearly we can see that we are presenting ourselves as a, quote, subservient to a higher force. That is Dasya Bhava, the first one that I just deleted. Dasya Bhava, subservient to a higher force, higher reality. And that higher reality is unseen, unknown. No? And to majority of us, beyond imagination, inconceivable. And we are trying to practice our love and devotion and the idea of selfless trust, and I mean, trustful surrender to that unknown, unseen, you know, unimaginable force. And most of it, this whole idea is based on sheer faith. Faith is based on what we have heard about that higher reality, what we have been told about that reality. Most of that idea of that trustful surrender and faith in God is based on our social conditionings. And it is very difficult for an ordinary average person to really go through the entire history of that faith and belief system in order to see how much of that faith and belief system is relevant, genuine, and how much is pure, and how much is contaminated by selfishness, fear, etc. How much is exploitative and how much is actually helpful. It's very difficult. In order to really get to that point, you need to have some knowledge of history, sociology, anthropology, you know, some of the history of the socio-economic structure of and political structure of those days when those belief systems were introduced, and how they ripened, how they got so well established in human consciousness, in our collective consciousness. It's too much to study in one lifetime. You know, how can, in order to really reach to the point where you completely, complete confidence, you can commit yourself to practice this trustful surrender to God. You know, it's not possible. You have to have the knowledge of anthropology, sociology, and spiritual history, socio-political history, etc., etc. And then you conclude, wow, this is why this thing happened. So example is, I give you example of India. Or even is Judeo-Christian tradition, you can see that where is the, you know, what was the main theme of Moses' teachings? What was his major, you know, what was the very spirit of his movement? Freedom, 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 freedom from poverty and exploitation. You know? The people, the Hebrew-speaking people, you know, or let's say Jewish people, were being used as slaves. And they were in very, they were living in very poor condition. They were oppressed. And therefore, when you analyze the fundamental teachings of Moses, as well as many, many other such teachers, prophets, those who came little before him and those who came little after him, or overall the tendency of Judaism, said, wow, this very much sense. The spirit of Christianity. Poverty was there, and it's more than crave for justice, it was crave for serving, helping, giving, caring, and making a difference. Christianity is grounded in that giving, loving, serving, sharing, and forgiving your neighbors. If let's say getting along with your neighbors, establishing a society, a neighborhood, and coming forward in time of need to help thy neighbor. What must have been the reason? Well, look at the political history of Middle East and Europe. It was run by feudal, monarchy system, where monarchy system was fed by the tributaries of feuds. Some top monarchs, they're supported by the monarchy, was supported and fed and sustained by the feudal system. Feudal system at the bottom level was simply, was fed by the pervasive anarchy. And in that, if one neighbor does not come forward to help his other neighbor, then you imagine what could be the condition of a society. How can a human being survive? Service to God, devotion to God, comes by giving, loving, sharing, so on and so on. And create a structure where everybody meets together at least once a week in a spiritually charged environment. And a spiritually charged environment means where everybody, people are there to give something to the church, and church has a responsibility to help others. It's like today's not-for-profit system, humanitarian not-for-profit NGO system, and it was designed within the structure of religion. Now, as soon as you start doing these kinds of intellectual analysis of a belief system, immediately you are declared, you are stamped, you are labeled as infidel or non-believer. Okay, that is almost in every culture. Hinduism, similar thing. Compassion, people talk about compassion. Whatever is normally missing in the society, that's what a religion promotes. When you read the stories of early Christian missionaries, those who went to Tibet, and say, oh my God, this is Tibetan Buddhism. Today, Tibetans are talking about compassion, compassion, compassion. But the history of Tibet is written by blood. You could not pay your tax and then how the splinters were put into your nails inside here and poked. You are buried half of your body, and the Tibetan dogs are left to take bite out of you because you did not pay your tax. You are traveler and entering that so-called sacred Tibet. And if you are found entering Tibet, you had no hope ever to return anymore. Read all the great travelers and writers, those who ever went to Tibet. No? Therefore, in that society, what was the greatest need? Compassion. Buddha talks about compassion because that was the least thing available. There was an extreme deficit of compassion during the time of Buddha. And there was extreme deficit of truthfulness during the time of Upanishads. There was extreme, deficit of self-discipline and self-discipline and control over senses. There was an extreme, indulgence. During the time of Mahavira, and there was an extreme carelessness about mental stability, about mental health, health of the mind. People were too much engrossed in the body during the time of Patanjali. People are completely, it's like mind even doesn't exist. All the problems are associated with body as long as you have, good time to eat, drink and be merry, that's done, He wrote the, book up, that is the time, it means there are lots of diseases. But people were too much inclined just to take care of the physical disease, people were not able to understand the importance of mind and its impact on body. So despite the fact he wrote one of the best books on Ayurveda, Patanjali wrote one of the best books on Ayurveda, and yet then he realized that without yoga, Ayurveda is just completely impotent and ineffective. Because mind is the, during his time, mind was the cause of all the misery, most of the misery. Well, social structures were fine. Political structure was okay, and the feudal system was not horrible. Everything was just fine. Only people had completely ignored their mind. Therefore, Patanjali places emphasis on mind. So this is an analytical way of looking at what is there and why. So why one is inclined? Why? What are we trying to do with all these different systems of yoga, bhakti? Within the field of yoga, we are talking about bhakti, and within bhakti, why somebody is looking at God as though God is father figure? Why somebody is looking at God as mother figure? Why somebody is looking at God as a master? Why somebody is looking at God as a friend? Why somebody is looking at God as a teacher? And when you analyze, you find that all of us are trying to get something out of God or get rid of something, with the help of God. And it is in that attempt we are trying to figure out how to find a connection with God. And none of this connection is truly based in knowledge. We are artificially trying to induce it. We have 0% understanding of God, and we are two different creatures. God is invisible, unknown, and subtle phenomena, and I'm completely visible, concrete, and individual. God is not, perceptible. God is not an individual. God is not mortal. And God is not in need of anything. And these are things absolutely missing in us. We are mortal and we are in lots of needs. We need lots of things. And we are full of desires. So these are two different creatures, or let's say ourselves at least, we know exactly what kind of creatures we are, and we are trying to establish a relationship with another creature, another phenomena, another reality, which is completely different from us. In our every worldly relationship, compatibility is very important, whereas in this relationship, incompatibility is that which is the ground for our relationship. No. More incompatible we are to the higher reality, the greater the region we feel that we should establish our relationship. We should establish our relationship with somebody who is immortal, who does not need anything, who is ever full, and list can go on. Look here, how in this particular system, therefore, the failure is built into the system. And highly acclaimed scriptures are reminding us that don't go that route. You will not reach anywhere. Compatibility is very important. Therefore, simple rule is Devo Bhutva Devam Yajet. Only after you have become Deva, or only after you have cultivated some of the quality of being bright, will you be able to find a healthy relationship between yourself and other bright being? No. There is no compatibility between me and somebody who is a drug dealer. No. I might not just completely in a rude way throw away a drug dealer. But the truth is, very gently I'll dismiss him. Okay. Because there is no compatibility. If criminal comes and asks my guidance, that this is wonderful institute, nobody, you know, doubts the institute, nobody is suspicious about institute, can you help me murder somebody? This is the best place. Because so far, no murder, no drug deals or anything have happened. Therefore, it probably will be the last place for police to really come and check. Therefore, I really need your help. Help me, please. What do you think? I'm a loving person. I'm a kind person. Will I be able to really practice stupidity in the name of love and compassion? Tell me. What is your feeling? Why don't you say something? Nothing will learn. Those people, they don't learn anything. They are very good. They are intent. Their whole, you know, the point is here. They learn or don't learn, but what about me? No. What about me? I just simply smell drug. That's it. I don't even need to go too much in details. I'll simply call Brian Falb. Brian, I feel a little bit odd. Can you take care of him? Done. Now, this is what we have hard time applying in relation to the higher reality. Higher reality is supposed to help us no matter what. That's why criminals also go to the temples and churches. They are seeking something. They are hoping to get something. Love, compassion, kindness, enlightenment. Are they looking into the churches? No. They are looking whatever their, you know, intrinsic, you know, building blocks of their mind is demanding. No. They will make a bigger donation if They made money. Let's say they came on the Sunday and something miraculously happened and they struck the deal on Monday. And by the end of Monday, you know, in a nice, hefty plastic bag, they were, you know, $200,000 cash. He will come back. He will not wait for next Sunday to come back to the church. He will visit right Monday evening or next day even. He will come on Tuesday. He will come and make a special appointment with the priest. I'm so blessed. Yesterday I came. It was so great miracle. I wish to take care of some, you know, your soup kitchen. So he will make a donation for the soup kitchen. Ignorance, avidya, is very powerful. It deludes us. In that delusion, deluded by our own, you know, ignorance, we force ourselves to believe that God is as foolish, ignorant, and childish as we are. And yet we tell, no, God is very powerful. God is very kind to me. Thank you, Lord, for that $200,000. No? This is not going to work. And yet, 100 years go by, 1,000 years go by, 2,000 years go by, 5,000 years go by, and by that time, that says that belief system becomes a tradition. And those time-honored customs become so-called standard practice of spirituality. Practice of that spirituality is expected to or believed to give us the highest, take us to the highest. And violation of that so-called rules and laws is supposed to make us doomed. This is where, according to the scriptures, the best form of relationship that we establish between ourselves and God in order to practice bhakti yoga is the relationship between teacher and student, as that of teacher and student. Why? First thing, how is it possible to cultivate that kind of understanding that we are ordinary soul, not completely doomed and hopeless, and yet we are in need of some knowledge and guidance. And we believe, we tell ourselves to believe and have strong conviction, unwavering conviction, unshakable conviction that there is a high reality that has that knowledge. And that higher reality is always available to us. All we have to do is just acknowledge the fact that the higher reality is always there to help us and guide us. With that faith, we continue seeking the guidance. How do we cultivate that faith? How can we make that faith so unshakable? And how we prepare ourselves to understand that here are some strengths and weaknesses in me. And despite all these weaknesses, I am not really a horrible seeker or student. I'm simply a seeker with certain shortcomings, but does not make me become a disqualified seeker. One shortcoming, two shortcomings, 20 shortcomings, they are simply shortcomings. They are not disqualifications. There is difference between these two. A shortcoming is a shortcoming. With training, with guidance, those shortcomings can be removed. Examples are always there, even in our school system. When we go to a school, we are not as good as our professors. And there is great understanding that one day, in all likelihood, we'll become as good as our professors, and in fact, maybe even more qualified than the professors, those who are guiding us. With that confidence and understanding, a student goes, and you may have your own experience in that. Like when a teacher sees his own student outshining the teacher, there is great joy in teacher's mind. Yes, if the teacher is, spiritually speaking, a low-grade teacher, you know, suffering from jealousy, envy, and all that stuff, you know, then of course, you know, that's a totally different story. But otherwise, normally, you know, it's always a great thing. You know, I've seen, even in the university system, how thrilled are the professors when they find students, you know, really doing good job. And so that is the case here in this particular situation, you know, that is Shishya Bhava, you know. So, like you have Sakhya Bhava, this is called Shishya Bhava. Shishya Bhava. Shishya means the student. One who is prepared to undergo a discipline. Such a person is called Shishya. Entire Yoga Sutra, from that standpoint, is the textbook of Bhakti Yoga. No. Why? You may read many, many, many other texts where God is described in so many different ways. God is absolute, divine, this, that. You know, in Yoga Sutra, God is Guru. That's it. Guru is not God. Remember this thing. God is Guru. What kind of Guru? Guru of all previous Guru. Why? Because he's primordial source of knowledge. Where is God? Right in your own, you know, being, right in your own lotus of your heart. What is the difference between you and Guru, that God? You are ordinary soul and ready to become an extraordinary person. And how will it happen when you gain that extraordinary knowledge and wisdom? Suddenly, with the help of that knowledge and wisdom, the extraordinary capacities that are lying dormant in you will become manifest. Each time you unveil one layer of that knowledge, the teaching force, guiding force inside you, you keep getting brighter and smarter and more intelligent and stronger. And your so-called ordinary human weaknesses are dropping away, evaporating. And you keep getting better, stronger, and clearer. And the wall between you and the higher divinity is becoming thinner and thinner. And long before they are totally wiped out, those walls become very transparent. You are able to see from this side, and you are also able to see the seer, the one who is seeing you from the other side. You know? Then at some point, there will be no need for this wall either. And yet there will be a wonderful, respectful attitude. And you will feel, you will have that, your joy will come from this realization that how wonderful is that guide, protector and provider who has always been there, even during that time when you are filled with so many shortcomings. And that reality was with you even when you never thought that you need it. Reality was there with you when you never prayed for being with you. No? That realization finally becomes transformed into pure bhakti, absolutely unconditional love and bhakti and devotion. There you do not need to make an effort to practice self trustful surrender, but rather it just happens. Before that, that effort-driven practice is called lower form of bhakti. And when it is totally effortless, it's called state of being, highest form of bhakti. So the higher bhakti, lower bhakti, is in every particular form of bhaktis that you see. One is where we are making an effort and trying our best to put our idea of inner divinity into practice. It's called lower bhakti. And when the idea of higher divinity becomes a stable and constant without any effort, then it's called higher bhakti. It's just there. So let us start. The next one will be the idea of God as inner primordial teacher and our relationship with that teacher or God, and how that evolves and matures into bhakti. That is the next one. Thank you. Oh my God. Darlene will forgive us. Okay, let's do prayer here. Reeve, let's do prayer.